Welcome to the ProPublica podcast. This is reporter David Epstein, and we're here today to talk with Corey Spivak and Kevin Crowe of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about their investigation, Landlord Games, which took a look at a system in Milwaukee where landlords will buy properties at auction, allow them to fall into disrepair while accumulating fines and property taxes that they don't pay, and then allow the city to foreclose on them, which erases the tax bill. And it's kind of amazing that this works, but this is reality. Welcome to the ProPublica podcast.
Thanks for having us.
So I was wondering if we can start just by sort of you putting the essence of your findings in a few short words, if that's possible.
Yeah, this is Carrie. Basically, what the story was we looked at a group of landlords and who had ran up considerable amount of money in fines from the municipal court. We're talking tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines. And they either had ridiculously easy payment plans, such as on a $10,000 fine, paying $100 every 60 to 90 days, or some didn't pay it at all because there was very little fear of any action by the authorities. Meanwhile, every Monday morning, they have the sheriff sales here of the foreclosed properties, and these same guys who were not paying their fines were showing up at the sheriff sales and buying hundreds of thousands, or over a couple of years, it was in the millions of dollars in properties. And to top it off, sometimes they weren't paying their property taxes. They owed huge sums of property taxes, which also didn't seem to bother them, because if a property is no longer turning a profit for the landlord, they'll sometimes stop paying the property taxes. And if you do that in Milwaukee, after 3 years, the city takes your property back, but the property tax debt is erased. So in all, it's a pretty good business for the landlords.
It's kind of amazing in some ways, and it's, I guess I just would have implicitly assumed that this wasn't possible because it seems like such a big sort of loophole. They're so simple. So it's these auctions, these weekly auctions, these landlords will go and they'll buy properties, basically let them deteriorate while accumulating fines for all sorts of building code violations and safety violations. Am I understanding that correctly?
Sometimes the best tips are the ones that you can't believe are true. But yeah, you were pretty much on target.
One of the landlords you both wrote about in the story, I think he was paying, doing sort of the $100 every couple months payment thing. And then there actually was, he was ordered jailed for something separate, like not paying for a lead paint cleanup. And what happened when he actually did face some real punishment in that case?
You don't mess with the federal judges. It was a federal case dealing with lead paint abatement. The judge repeatedly said, I want to see the money to do the lead paint abatement. The landlord did not come up with it. Finally, the judge got mad and sent him to jail. And it took 7 days. He found $700,000. And that was his get out of jail card.
So that obviously makes it seem like he wasn't paying $100 on his fines, on his tens of thousands of dollars of fines, because he didn't have the money to come up with, because he obviously found $700,000 in the couch cushions or wherever he found it within a week. And there was a really interesting scene, I think, when one of you must have tried to question that particular landlord in the story. He drove off in a fancy car, if I remember that correctly. Can you describe that in a little more detail? Because I think some of the reporters who probably listen to our podcast, and probably also journalism students, that can be kind of an uncomfortable thing to do.
Well, we're big believers in trying to do the personal visits, especially in a story like this. It's too easy to hang up on you on a phone call or to avoid the phone call. We had gone to his office repeatedly. It's a very small, kind of dumpy little office on the north side of Milwaukee. He was never there when we went there. Did see him a couple of times at the sheriff's sales, but those were very brief conversations. And one day I was driving back from a house that I just looked at, and wasn't too far, so I figured I'd just drop over there again, and it was just sheer dumb luck. As I was pulling in, there was Will getting into his Corvette, and I kind of waved hello and got out. He waited for, he got into the car, but he didn't speed off until I went up to him and attempted to do an interview. I was writing a police report, I guess I would say words were exchanged. I used the one quote that we really could use. He wouldn't go into anything specific. And then he took off in the vet.
And when you said Will, I think his name was Will Sherrard, if I remember. So you mentioned that sometimes the best tips are the ones that are sort of the hardest to believe. To the extent that you're, you know, you can discuss it, can you tell us how this story came on your radar in the first place?
This is Kerry again. It was just we had been doing a couple of stories dealing with landlords and looking at the issue. Kevin was gathering already a lot of the tax foreclosure data. And it was talked about to us that it was frustrating to some of the people involved in the process that there'd be fines issued against these guys and they weren't paying them, yet they were still buying properties. We had no idea how much they were buying in properties. We were somewhat surprised by that.
Right, right. And this is Kevin. And this is one of the things, I mean, most of these guys were known actors, not, you know, Divine Momentum and Devin Harris necessarily, but the other guys, Will Sherrard, Muhammad Chaudhry, Elijah Rashid, I mean, these are property owners who've been around Milwaukee for a long time. And what they were doing at this point, using a system that the city has kind of created to accommodate a lot of the people who have some real problems in the city. So the muni courts, for example, the municipal courts, I mean, they're letting people out on payment plans because, you know, as their head judge says, they don't want to run a debtor's prison. And they kind of have these pretty lax court rules. They have walk-in court hours. You know, you don't have to have a court date. You can go in and kind of do that. Well, some of these guys were taking advantage of that, some of the walk-in hours. You know, that way there's not a city attorney present to challenge their payment plan and say, no, you know, this guy has money. He's involved in all these other cases, so maybe it should be difficult. And then that's kind of the same thinking on the tax delinquency and the tax foreclosure. I think they can take a property after 1 year.
Right.
I mean, they can initiate tax foreclosures as soon as you're 1 year delinquent in tax. Now, Milwaukee has had it very tough economically. I mean, times are rough for a lot of people here. And the mortgage foreclosure crisis was kind of one gut punch. And tax foreclosures are another one. There are a lot of people who've been in their homes a long time on fixed incomes who are having trouble paying. And so the city kind of took this approach to, well, we'll give you, you know, we're kind of give you 3 years, work with people, put them on payment plans, those kinds of things. But that was just kind of another area that these guys could kind of take advantage of and just say, hey, you know, we get to hold on to our properties for another 3 years without paying the taxes.
That brings up two interesting things. The first is that that seems good. It seems very reasonable that a city would react to its citizens and say, look, let's work something out reasonable here. So we're not being too harsh on the wrong people and so that we give people a chance to stay in their homes. And I hadn't really thought about that. And now it makes me wonder, I'm sure there'll be some impact, maybe there already is, of your story in terms of city action. I'm curious if you have any insight into what that might be, if there's anything already moving, and whether because a few bad apples have been using the system this way, it might also then make it harder for people who are sort of legitimately trying to stay in their homes.
This is Kerry. One thing they did immediately, actually, they did this before the story was published, but after we did the interviews, they put in a standing motion so the city attorneys will be notified whenever somebody comes into the court for a payment plan. So that way, if Will Sherrard or Muhammad Chaudhry or whoever comes in and say, I can't pay the $10,000 fine, can I have a pay $100 or $200, there'll be a city attorney there who can challenge that and say, hey, wait a minute, Judge, this guy bought five properties last week. So initially, that was the, I wouldn't call it knee-jerk, but very quick reaction by the city.
So that's really good. I mean, so that's some very, very tangible impact, it sounds like, right away. Have you been pleased with that, or do you think it goes far enough?
This is Kevin. I mean, you know, that's up for them to decide, really. I mean, they've got a... These are all processes, for the most part, that take place at the municipal level. Now, the sheriff sales, I mean, and so the city can kind of handle that stuff on its own, right? They can, you know, work with the judges. The judges are independently elected, and the city attorney's office, as long as they can put in a standing order like that or a standing objection to be notified and be present, those are things that the city can do. And one of the things that I think the mayor has said that he'd like to do, and I think a few other politicians around here have said, is that they would like maybe a few changes in the processes of sheriff sales. So right now, I mean, pretty much anybody can buy a property at sheriff sale as long as you have cash. one of the things that the city does for its tax delinquencies, so, I mean, it forecloses on properties, and then the city is actually a pretty sizable like real estate company at this point because it has a lot of properties that it has acquired through tax foreclosures. One of the things they do is for purchases of their properties, they check to make sure people don't have a ton of outstanding muni court fees or any outstanding tax delinquencies. So they kind of screen their buyers a little more. But again, I mean, that's something they can take care of themselves. They can institute those rules. Those are the properties they're selling. I think for the share sales, I mean, they pretty much need a state law changed.
Exactly. The only thing I would add to that, is Kerry, is that we have a lot of politicians right now running around saying we've got to do something about this, but they have no real clue what exactly that something is.
Kevin, to go backward to something you mentioned, Devin Harris and Divine Momentum. Divine Momentum, of course, was one of the companies that was holding property in the story. Can you tell us a little bit why that particular LLC was particularly interesting and sort of warranted extra focus in the story?
Yeah, this is Kevin. So I was doing a lot of the data analysis for this. So we looked at a number of different data sets. We had the share of sales, you know, from about 2007 to present, municipal court fees, tax delinquencies, and a few other sets that I'm probably missing out on right now. One of the big kind of areas where Divine Momentum was bubbling to the top was in tax delinquencies and muni court fees. And so it was a company that had rung up a lot fees for municipal code violations, property code violations, and then they weren't paying their taxes on time. They had a number of properties that had been referred to a law firm for collection, and it was a company's name, you know, Divine Momentum Real Estate LLC. I mean, we didn't expect to see that name there. There were a few names that we did expect to see, like we kind of talked about. There were some known actors, but this one came up Los Angeles-based, and that immediately got our attention as to, well, we kind of wonder who this is. Most of the other people are based in Wisconsin and really kind of based around Milwaukee. But this was kind of intriguing, and that's kind of where Kerry set to work.
And then the way we figured out who owned it or who has an ownership interest, there was initially the registered agent was a guy by the name of Johnny Ridley, who's a local. And Johnny, we noticed that he was sued by Divine Momentum for eviction. He was evicted from a Divine Momentum property. Well, when you're evicting your registered agent, that's probably a pretty good sign that there's trouble there. And so we asked around, and I was told by a source that, you know who this is, don't you, who Divine Momentum is? He said it was the basketball player, the guy from the Bucks. And I was like, okay, I had not heard that at all before, and I was like, you know, which guy again? I can't remember, you know. And then he pulled a file, and he said, oh, no, it wasn't the Bucks, it was UW, Devin Harris. So once you had that breakthrough, you had something to play with, and we reached out to Johnny, took a bunch of calls, but he agreed to talk to us, and he confirmed it. And then we had information from other sources as well. And then we just put in the open records request to the city. They didn't know who it was. All they knew was Divine Momentum dealing with the lawyers. And they gave us the letters through an Open Records Act request between the city and Divine Momentum, where Divine Momentum was trying to get out of paying the fine, saying, hey, we've done some repairs. We've been paying some of our fines. Waive the remainder. That's where the quote came from, that they were the number one offender in Milwaukee, I think, a year or two ago.
And just to elaborate on Devin Harris, so he was a University of Wisconsin star, a former NBA All-Star. Of course, there you guys go picking on people who are working two jobs, right? He's a landlord and an NBA player. And that's a tricky thing, I think, because, you know, I did investigative work at Sports Illustrated in my previous job, and until I went through it, wasn't really able to anticipate some of the rage in the backlash. You know, sometimes when I would reveal something about a team that people held dear or a player that was part of a community. I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about what the reaction to that has been, because when you say anything negative about a star player from a local college and a local NBA team at one point, I think it can get very emotional, and especially when you also live in the same community. I think that's more difficult than most of what I had to do, and I'd be curious to hear about it.
This is Kerrigan. There hasn't been a whole lot of local backlash. There was people from City Hall were surprised by it. They didn't know it was him. There, part of it might be because he plays for the Mavericks. You know, he's been out of Wisconsin, so you haven't caught a whole lot of that. We caught a little bit from Devin, where he tweeted, I forget what his exact words were, the story was false and irresponsible journalism from my hometown paper or something like that. But outside of that, there hasn't been, you know, real negative stuff, real nasty stuff thrown at us.
That's great. And I know he also tweeted, he said he's, you know, considering all legal options, which is kind of something that pro athletes always say whenever someone accuses them of something. And usually, you know, that makes it look like they're very serious in their denials, and then they kind of just let it fade away. And I don't know if your lawyers have told you not to talk about this aspect of it, but I'd be curious if that's gone anywhere, if he's contacted the paper, his representatives, about any kind of legal action.
Knock on wood, as of today, there's been nothing.
This is Kevin, and I think one of the factors in that is that, you know, Monica Kim, mm-hmm. his attorney, really ended up talking about Devin Harris quite a bit in the emails, trying to get us to not name Devin Harris. Kerry was talking with her, but, I mean, Kerry's a great investigative reporter. I mean, he got a lot of this stuff into email, too, and so.
Yeah, this is Kerry again. Monica Kim, in the numerous interviews, at first it was, I won't say anything. And then as the conversations went on, she was using Devin's name in the conversations. I was always using it, and then she was responding and said that it was Devin's decision not to sue Johnny Ridley when they got into a fight. And the email Kevin was just referring to, I'm looking at what we quoted from that. It's Kim asked, quote, that you do not mention his involvement until a later date, in which even Devin himself can sit with you for an exclusive interview to finally let the cat out of the bag on who's behind Divine Momentum Real Estate and why. Geez, we couldn't believe when we got that. It's in writing from Divine Momentum's attorney.
And, you know, and I'm sure when you got contacted, you said, great, we'd love to sit down with him. But I think it sounded like the offer wasn't as good as it might have first appeared, right?
She said I asked when would he be available. She said 12 to 18 months. And, you know, she said, you know, when I bring it up with the editors, I said, sure, and I did. Although, you know, in my mind, in this business, I'm thinking 12 to 18 months. I don't know if I'm employed in 12 to 18 months. You know, that's an eternity in this business right now.
And also, given that Devin just went on vacation from the NBA playoffs, it seems like he should have been available a lot sooner than that.
Good point.
Well, this is Kevin. We'll leave that one to you. the offer is always out there. In one of the response stories after Devin tweeted that our story was false and irresponsible reporting, I mean, the calls go back out immediately. I mean, the door is always open here. He knows where to find us, and he's got the contact information. So, of course, we'd always love to talk with him.
Kerry, it sounds like when you were talking with Divine Momentum's attorney, I mean, one thing I really learned from a reporter I partnered with a lot at Sports Illustrated named Selena Roberts was that going back to people a lot can be really useful. And sometimes I would find myself not wanting to do that. You know, I'd have the one conversation with somebody who wasn't that happy with me and say, okay, I did what I have to do. But started to learn that really sustaining that dialogue and going back and going back and going back can be really useful. And I don't know if that's something you found as well or you just had to in this case, but can you describe a little bit of sort of how you managed that and what your reporting strategy was?
Oh, sure. It was actually pretty friendly type interviews initially. I mean, I don't mind. I'll go back to the guy time and time again. With her, we got to her because I found a number that I actually thought was Devin's, and it turned out to be his mother, who's, I'm not sure, I think she's still in Milwaukee. It was a Milwaukee area code. And I told her why I was calling. I gave her a lot of detail because I was kind of looking for if she knew what I was talking about. I couldn't tell one way or the other. And then she said she would pass it on to Devin. And the next thing I knew, I had a phone call from Monica. Mm-hmm. And I knew the name Monica Kim because I'd seen it on different papers already. And it was, like I said, very friendly, and she, most of it was her trying to talk me out of doing the story. Everything was on the record. There was never once a request to be off the record, so it was on the record from the get-go. Harris might be making a good claim. We don't know who's right or wrong, but, you know, it was a good argument that they were making, that there was troubles caused because back home, the property manager may not have been doing the job. We don't know if that's true or not, but that's what he was claiming. And we talked to her in depth about that, and she was very agreeable, and I think that's why the email that she wrote to us, where she basically confirms it again, that it's Devin Harris, came about. But I bet you I talked to her probably 10 times or so.
You're sort of confirming that this was Devin Harris seems to have been a really neat confluence of some data and documentary reporting and some traditional interviewing. And Kevin, I was wondering if maybe you can talk a little bit about some of the data reporting, how it helped in this story, and maybe what some of the challenges were.
One of the main ways it helped was kind of getting the scope of what these folks were up to. You know, these guys don't represent everybody who's doing this. It's pretty laborious just going through all the LLC information, trying to make sure everybody's connected appropriately enough to be able to pin some numbers to them. And so that took some time, and cleaning data took time, and making sure that sales are final. So, I mean, you know, just because somebody bought something at a sheriff's sale doesn't mean that they actually got it. You have to go back through and check the actual court records to make sure that a judge approved the sale. And that, you know, something was filed with Department of Revenue. So even in as much as there were a lot of data sets involved, even the data sets required a fair amount of reporting on the back, you know, just documentation on the back for each one of these properties. You know, all of these figures, and there are at least figures, because there are some transactions that were questionable that ultimately we decided not to include because we didn't have it all the way. We didn't feel, or maybe the documentation was a little hazy as to ultimate ownership. So that helped a lot. And I mean, it did bring up, I mean, we knew to a degree some of the people we were looking for, but not everybody. So two or three came up that we didn't know, and some others have come up since. So they're just kind of things that we'll keep, it's just data we keep looking at. I mean, one of the other problems with the data is that some of it was just really dirty. Just because something said it was a property sale in Milwaukee didn't necessarily mean it was in the city of Milwaukee. And we were focused in on the city of Milwaukee for this.
And Kevin also had a deal with me coming up to him every day saying, are you done yet?
So we just have a minute left here, and I was wondering if there was ever a point in this investigation where you thought you were stuck and it might not come to fruition.
On my end, not really. It was just a matter of time. It was just getting the time to put it together.
Yeah, this is Kevin, and I'll echo Carrie on that. I just wonder if we got enough in there.
Yeah, there'll be more coming.
That's really want to thank you guys for coming on. I thought the story was fantastic. Again, it's in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The title of the investigation is Landlord Games, and you won't be able to read it without being, I think, frustrated and aghast and also impressed by the reporting. And I really appreciate you guys taking time for us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening to the ProPublica podcast. We'll see you again next week.